Hey, folks. Did you ever walk into a packy, as we used to call them back in the day in Massachusetts? You may know it as a wine store, and have no idea what to buy. Well, that was me for a long, long portion of my very, very long life. But now, I don't even think about that. I don't have to. And the reason is Naked Wines. Naked Wines is this podcast, obviously sponsored by Naked Wines. Naked Wines is a wine club that directly connects you to the world's best independent winemakers, and you can get world-class wine delivered straight to your door. Use our code MAJORITY for the code and the password at nakedwines.com and get $100 off your first order. That's six bottles for $39.99. I don't know if I had the full half dozen of Naked Wines at Thanksgiving, but I remember a Syrah and a French wine that we got from Naked Wines. They were delicious.
I think I had that Syrah or one of their Syrahs too. It was great.
Yeah, they have a whole bunch. I mean, they have a huge range of wines. And here's the rub. My sister used to rep wines from Italy for a long time, and she would always tell me, like, the markup, you cannot believe the markup, because there's so many middle people between the grower and ultimately the person who sells you the bottle of wine. Well, Naked Wine brings you amazing wine straight from the winery at up to 60% less than you would pay in a store. They cut out extra costs like middleman markups. Winemakers can pass those savings on to you without skimping on quality. Honestly, the thing about Naked Wines that is so fantastic, you get to try a huge variety of wines. They're all high quality, and they're all like substantially less than you would pay in a wine store. Now is the time to join Naked Wines community. Head to nakedwines.com/majority. Click enter voucher. Put in my code majority for both the code and the password, and you'll get $100 off your first order. That's six bottles for only $39.99. And that's with shipping included. That's $100 off your first six bottles at nakedwines.com/majority. Use the code and password majority for six bottles of wine for $39.99. We'll put the links and that information in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Now time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, December 3rd, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jessica Burbank, investigative journalist and contributor to Drop Site News, on Flock, a surveillance system coming to a town near you. Also on the program today, K. Sabil Rahman, author and professor of law at Cornell Law School, on the third reconstruction. Meanwhile, ICE begins operations in New Orleans and in the Twin Cities area. And despite a win, Republicans are shaken to the core by Tennessee's 7th special election last night. November's private payroll measure dropped by 30,000. They were expecting 40,000 bump. Remember, it's the holiday season. Trump regime holding SNAP administration funds for blue states hostage unless the states hand over enrollee data. Ex-Honduran president convicted of drug trafficking freed on the Trump pardon because, you know, he's so worried about drugs coming into this country. Elise Stefanik having lost Mamdani as a linchpin for her New York State governor run attacks Mike Johnson as a deep statist. Deep stater? I don't know. Ayanna Pressley announces she will not run against Markey in the Massachusetts Senate race. That's a bummer. Larry Summers banned from the economics profession for life. Didn't know you could do that, but I'm glad it happened.
I mean, why did it take them so long?
And I got a list.
Yeah.
11 Indiana Republicans have been targeted with swatting or threats of violence for not being in favor of redistricting in their state. And Trump, this just breaking, pardons Henry Cuellar, the Democratic congressman in Texas, who may or may not lose his seat anyways.
He's an anti-abortion right-wing Democrat already.
But Trump saw that he was up on bribery charges and said, none of that. Oh, not while I'm president.
But Dorsey points out that Hakeem Jeffries said that Trump's pardon was the right outcome.
Oh, way to fight. Way to fight. All this and more on today's Majority Report. It is
hump day.
That's right. Emma Vigeland coming in strong with her coined phrase.
Did I stutter? It's hump day. Okay.
What happened?
I was just trying to bring energy to it.
I like the fold right after immediately.
Yeah. I mean, silence like was like a stab in the heart.
Well, I wasn't sure what you were doing.
I'm so red, and I feel myself getting so red, and I hate when that happens.
I'm sorry.
Oh, look at it. Just completely changed color. I can't help it.
Well,
oh.
Fortunately, we have the color settings on the cameras. So
right. I need to look like Sam yesterday. More green.
We got a lot to get to today. This race last night in Tennessee, it's a big deal. You'll recall a 22-point margin for Donald Trump, a 21-point margin for the congressman, the former Congressman Green from there. And the biggest, the most important fact about this election was the turnout. The turnout was almost identical to what it was in the midterm elections in 2022. When you would have your most motivated Republican voters coming out when they had a Democratic president. The turnout numbers were the same, but Republicans lost 15 points, essentially. And that is a big deal. Here is CNN.
We are seeing something that at the moment suggests the Republican might hold on to win. Matt Van Epps has just taken the lead. I'll explain why in a minute. And if you look through the map, you could see a progression to where Matt Van Epps can hold on. I can also give you a scenario, though, where the Democrat Afton Bain wins. But the fact that we're talking about this race at 9 o'clock at night in the East on this night, a special election, tells you everything you need to know. Republicans are going to be nervous even if they win this seat because Matt Van Epps is leading this race right now, but by less than a point. Less than a point, Caitlin. Let's just say he stretches that out a little bit. Right? Okay. But just a little more than a year ago, on quaint little day, November 2024, Election Day, Mark Green, the former incumbent in this congressional district, won it by 22 points. The man who sits in the White House, Donald Trump, won it by 22 points. So to your point about Democratic overperformance, or you might call it Republican underperformance, as we watch what has happened this year in Virginia, in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania, in Mississippi, in Georgia, and elsewhere, in special elections and big statewide elections, Democrats are coming out to vote. the Republican coalition is not performing. And here tonight in Tennessee, again, Republicans may well hold this seat. But tomorrow, imagine, Mark Green won this by 22 points. Matt Van Epps might win it inside of single digits somewhere. If you are a Republican anywhere else in America who comes from a district Donald Trump carried by, say, 12, maybe even 15 points, you're thinking, yesterday I didn't think I was vulnerable next year. Maybe I better think about that again. So it changes the battlefield, the map, for the midterm elections potentially. It could also, Caitlin, change a lot of conversations between Republicans and the Trump White House about those Obamacare subsidies, about what do we do next time a government shutdown prospect comes up, about how do we vote on things Trump wants to do that maybe the people in my district don't like. So the margin here tonight matters. Even if the Republicans hold on, if it's that narrow margin, then it's going to cause jitters in the Republican Party. And just want to check on Davidson County in Nashville. Only half of the vote in here. So I'm speaking.
Okay, we don't need the rest of that. That was obviously last night. And it, in fact, was single digits. Now, it was 9 points in the end. So it's right on the cusp. If this was around 5 points, I had predicted yesterday, if it was around 5 points, you would see like multiple resignations from Republicans. Just to be clear, 100 Republican held seats are less pro Trump than this seat. There are Republicans won 23 House seats in 2024 that gave Donald Trump an 8 point or lower margin over Harris. Now, that 8 point margin, those 23 House seats are in grave jeopardy of flipping. Grave jeopardy. And again, you would look at this if it was a special election and generally say, well, it's an apples to oranges comparison. So you can't do a 1-to-1 15 point swing. But when the turnout numbers are match the midterms in 2020, then it's a real problem. Here's Harry Emden.
Let's talk about the numbers. Republicans should be running for the hills this morning because the blue wave is building, my dear friend, Mr. Berman. What are we talking about here? Well, Matt Van Epps, the Republican candidate, he won it by 9, but this is a district that Donald Trump won by 22 points, 15 points, 17 points. This is a 13-point gain for the Democrats in terms of the margin, and excuse time for Republicans is over, because I hear all about these special elections. Oh, the turnout's so low, it's not representative of what happened in the midterm election. The turnout last night in Tennessee's 7th District was equal to the turnout in the 2022 midterm election. So the blue wave, it seems to be building right out of center of Tennessee.
Interesting. I mean, so in terms of the numbers, the turnout looked like a regular midterm election, not a special election.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And of course, we have a midterm. What about 11 months from
now? All right. What have we seen in terms of trends in all the special elections the last year?
Okay. You know, I wouldn't necessarily give a hoot and a hollering about one special election in Tennessee. I love the people in Central Tennessee, but Central Tennessee is nothing special compared to the rest of the country. But what we see happening is take a look here. Okay, 2025 U.S. House special elections. Dems outrunning Kamala Harris. A lot of blue here. A lot of blue, which is what I think the nation might look like a year from now if these results hold. Arizona 7. You see a 17 over outperformance of Kamala Harris. 23 points in Florida 1. 16 points in Florida 6. 13 points in Tennessee 7. 28 points in Texas 28. And then 17 points in Virginia 11. So we've seen it throughout the nation, whether you go from the suburbs of Washington, D.C., all the way to the Southwest in Arizona, whether you're looking at Texas, whether you're looking at Tennessee, whether you go down to Florida, we have seen the Democratic outperformance of Kamala Harris happening across the political map. What happened last night in Tennessee ain't just staying in Tennessee. It is spreading itself throughout the nation. As I said, to me, looking at these results, it looks like a blue wave is building.
Right, now, the one thing that strikes me, put that that image back up there. I would be curious to know what the Latino population is across all of those districts. And I imagine that it is higher in the districts where you see a higher outrunning of Harris.
I mean,
Florida and Texas.
Florida, Arizona.
I mean, I have no idea what those numbers are there.
Guess.
But it would be interesting to look at those and make an assessment based upon that, because I think that that is a cohort that has really, I think, done a 180.
Yeah.
In terms of the way they voted in 2024.
So thus far, the basically kind of average swing in the special elections since Trump got elected has been 17 points. G. Elliott Morris has a write-up about this on his Substack, Strength in Numbers, which is a really good follow. And if you compare that to 2018, in the lead-up to 2018, the special election margin was Democrats beating their benchmarks in those special elections by around 11 points. And then the Democrats in 2018 won the House popular vote by 7 points, and there was that swing. So this means that when you compare it to 2018, again, you know, in the first midterms or the special elections leading up to the midterms in Trump's first term, these numbers are outperforming that. So that is looks like it could actually be a very positive sign for them in the fall.
And or, also, yeah. We have a couple of redistricting that has taken place that one has to wonder if those redistricting, those gerrymandering is dummy mandering, because
right. It
was incumbent upon, you know, certain groups of people voting for Republicans that they, it looks like now, may not be doing that. So really, the real relevance to this at the end of the day is, how does this impact Republican lawmakers? How many decide to quit, to retire, because they don't want to go through a bruising campaign only to lose? And then even with the prospect, if they win, that they're going to lose the House. And how many are going to want to hang on to their jobs and are going to start bucking the White House?
Yep.
And this could cause like some Republican lawmakers to step on Trump's IV that's going into his hand to give him the medication just to get him out of office quicker.
It's something to consider that they may be considering.
I don't know medical stuff. So.
Yeah. The Morris's model also basically says that this would translate, if they use 2018, to something like an 8-point swing for Democrats, which would be like from R+2 to D+6. An 8-point swing means that Ohio, Maine, North Carolina, and then even Iowa and Texas, in terms of those Senate races, are in play. And that's very important to note, because obviously a swing in the Senate, I mean, if the Democrats are able to take back both chambers, that's a way to actually materially curb this authoritarianism that that Trump has overseen, and the fascism. And like, we're going to be talking to Rahman in a sec, but this is a way, I think, to basically push back against this fascism. We'll get to that.
In a moment, we're going to be talking to Jessica Burbank about Flock, and then Kay Sabeel Rahman about what do we do if we do take back the House and the Senate, et cetera. But first, a couple of words from our sponsors. When I started this podcast, everything largely I was ultimately responsible for it, which is exactly why I did not want to have a merch store. Too much work. Going to be too complicated. I don't need more things on my plate. But people wanted a merch store. We want the Trump slump stickers. We want the Emma Majority hats or shirts. And ultimately, I capitulated. And it turns out, super easy. Why? Because of Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, from household names like Magic Spoon to brands just getting started. Shopify has hundreds of ready-to-use templates to help you build an online store to match your brand, whether that's beautiful, edgy, minimalist, or, you know, like sort of a DIY homemade, like we got on the Majority Report. Shopify is packed with AI tools to help you put together product descriptions, page headlines, can even enhance your product photography. And best yet, Shopify helps you with managing inventory, international shipping, processing, returns, and beyond. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. The thing that's also great about Shopify is when we do a live show, we sell our merch. We can integrate it easily with our Shopify backend for the web page. Also, Shopify, you'll notice it's on our YouTube right now. You can integrate it with all of your social media platforms. Super easy, totally turnkey. Turn your big business idea into cha-ching with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your $1 per month trial. Start selling today at Shopify.com/majority. Go to Shopify.com/majority. Shopify.com/majority right now. We'll put that description in the podcast and YouTube descriptions, I should say. We'll put the links in there. Also, today's episode brought to you by Wild Grain. What is Wild Grain? It is the first bake from frozen box that sends you artisanal breads, seasonal pastries, and fresh pastas. All items conveniently bake in 25 minutes or less. Unlike store-bought, Wild Grain uses a slow fermentation process. It's easier on your belly, richer in nutrients and antioxidants, made with simple ingredients you can pronounce. Wild Grain boxes are fully customizable. They're constantly adding seasonal and limited time products for you to enjoy. Like right now, I see I can barely even read this without my mouth watering.
Yeah.
They have Tear and Share cranberry pecan rolls. Parmesan herb biscuits and apple pie bites. I've got some apple cider donuts still in my freezer that, like, every time I open up the freezer, I'm like, oh, God, I'm supposed to be saving these for Saul. And I had some waffles, like Belgian waffles, and that didn't – Saul did not get those. Sorry, buddy. But they'll send you bread. They'll send you croissants. Super easy. You put them in the oven. The most any of these things take are 25 minutes, but you don't have to do anything. You literally just put it on a tray and it comes out and it is delicious, fresh baked bread goods, like the cinnamon rolls and the donuts. I might have a breakdown. But the bread, the croissants are delicious, honestly.
Write an
so
RFK
good.
Style erotic poem I know. For these things.
The harvest. Wild Grain is here to make you look like a baking expert without the stress. You can even buy some of their items in bulk. And you can give it as a gift as well, which is a great gift.
Oh, yeah.
You can giving a box or sending an e-gift card to their inbox. Wild Grain makes for the perfect gift for loved ones or to bring as a host. Honestly, so easy to do. So delicious. It's crazy. For a limited time, Wild Grain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box, plus free croissants in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/majority to start your subscription. You heard me. Free croissant in every box. $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/majority. Folks, this is a great gift to give to your parents. You time it so that when you go to visit them for Christmas, they've got all the stuff. They bake it for you. You try out the stuff that you love. Mm. Then you get it yourself.
It's a gift for yourself and for your family.
That's the way you work it. Also, sponsoring the program today, ZBiotics. ZBiotics is the makers of the world's first genetically engineered probiotics. It is ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic. Your first drink of the night for a better tomorrow. It's engineered by a team of PhD microbiologists. Pre-alcohol is a probiotic drink that breaks down the byproduct of alcohol, which is responsible for rough days after drinking. This is great for I mean, I went to a couple of parties recently, if you can believe it or not. And I have the first drink I have of the night is Z-Biotics. I feel great. When we were doing Mom Donnie's coverage, first drink of the night I had was one of these Z-Biotics pre-alcohol probiotic drinks. And the next day I come in, I do the show. It's like I'm as fresh as a daisy. And if I was one of those people, I even did my, like, you know, 7-minute workout regime.
Whoa.
Which is very difficult for me to do on days where I don't feel good. But Z-Biotics, the way it deals with this is that it turns out, like, what when you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in your gut. It's the buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme which breaks this byproduct down. Honestly, I have taken this Z-Biotics for a couple of years, and I have never had a situation where the next day I didn't feel like I hadn't had anything to drink the night before. You got to be responsible, obviously, but you can make the most of every toast this holiday season. Don't forget to bring pre-alcohol along for the ride. Go to zbiotics.com/majority to learn more. Get 15% off your first order when you use majority at checkout. Zbiotics backed with 100% money back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they will refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/majority. Use the code majority at checkout for 15% off. Check it out. Quick break. We come back. Jessica Burbank, investigative journalist, contributor to DropSite News, on Flock, a surveillance system coming to a town near you. We'll be right back. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Viglin on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Jessica Burbank, a investigative journalist and contributor to DropSite News. And Jessica, thanks for coming on. You've written a piece and did a hour-long documentary on Flock, and specifically how it had to deal with a town in Westchester County up in just outside of New York City. But this is something that we've been hearing from our listeners happening all across the country. A lot of this going on in Colorado, in Denver, I should say, in Washington State. This is happening all across the country. What is Flock?
So thanks for having me. Hello, Majority Report. Flock is a $7.5 billion company, which is crazy. They grew extremely big through securing government contracts largely behind closed doors. And what they do is they produce license plate readers, live view cameras, sort of surveillance technology. And they sell this to police departments and say, this will help you solve crime. But really what they offer is not just this like AI-powered license plate reading technology. They offer a network of license plate reading technology across the entire country that is searchable and usable by whatever law enforcement signs a contract with them.
So, and this is happening on like a municipal level, or is it happening on a state level or both?
It's crazy. It's municipal. So you would think that mass surveillance coming to America would be this thing that Congress has to vote on, and there would be heated debate and people would talk about it on the nightly news. Not at all. It's a police chief comes to a city council, whatever municipal body you have. In the case of Scarsdale, it was the village board. And they usually through quiet consent agendas where it's lumped in with a sum of what's supposed to be non-controversial policy items, routine stuff. And they say, yeah, we would like to have $60,000. In the case of Scarsdale, it was over $1 million to implement license plate reading cameras all over town. And the town board typically votes these through without any public notice, any debate, without it even being an agenda item.
I mean, the fact that this is Scarsdale, for people that are outside of New York, I would be hard-pressed to think of a wealthier, more affluent suburb in New York State. It's kind of notorious for that. Were you trying to highlight Scarsdale for a particular reason on that front? I know you highlighted other communities in your piece as well, but the fact that it's there, too, I think says a lot.
Yeah, I grew up not far away from Scarsdale in Stamford, Connecticut. My dad's a contractor. And he said, you know, Scarsdale is this crazy rich town. And it's so wealthy that they ship such expensive rock and landscaping in that it's a part of the village code that you can't ship any of it out without a special permit. That's the kind of money we're talking about here. And I had a friend in town, Josh Frankel, who's in the documentary and quoted a lot in the piece. We'd worked together before, and he was messaging me like every day. It's so crazy what's happening here with this Flock stuff. We're getting these license plate readers. It's mass surveillance. And finally, one day I got on the phone with him and he explained it. And I did an online search, you know, what's going on with Flock. There was hardly anything, like no coverage. So how does a mass surveillance company that's $7 billion in size with funding from Andreessen Horowitz and Founders Fund, Peter Thiel money, how is it this big with no mainstream coverage? And so I immediately knew there was a story here, but I got lucky that I knew someone in a town where this was happening live. And we could catch the village board as they tried to bury this. I talked to Flock on the phone, and they agreed to a recorded interview. Now, no one at Flock will talk to me. They're very secretive. But it was a really lucky turn of events. And Scarsdale was perfect because there were so many people in town, including people like Charles Seif, who are NSA, former employees. They're really aware of what this technology can do. So it was lucky that it was an affluent town where people had time to show up and fight this, which might not be the case in a working class town.
I'm looking at a website, banishbigbrother.com/flockcameramap, and it's nuts. There are so many of these all around the country, and it definitely feels like this was the strategy. We can go in and be a lot quieter about this and a lot more successful in going city by city rather than going on a federal level to do this. But what's the pitch? Like, I mean, I don't know, I know Scarsdale by reputation, but is there that much crime there that somebody on the city council is going like, oh yeah, we need to have like all of this. Is it like, how are they securing these contracts where I would imagine municipalities are like, we don't have a lot of money to throw around necessarily. Unless you're like, you know, in the midst of some type of like crazy crime spree, I can't even see how this would be entertained.
Scarsdale's a famously safe town. Their main crimes are petty larceny and identity theft. Not things that these cameras are going to solve. I mean, the petty theft was the neighborhoods are so safe that people were told by the village board at one point, stop locking your keys in your car. So license plate readers aren't going to solve these kinds of crimes. So why was it that they needed 172 surveillance cameras in a town like Scarsdale? The money was not in the village budget. It was expected to come from a federal grant, which didn't end up coming through. But Flock goes and meets directly with the police chief. And I think the pitch is simple. Just if you have these cameras, you're not going to have to devote as much resources and personnel to solving crimes because you can track people wherever they're going. You have a body of evidence here, which is a major Fourth Amendment concern. You're supposed to have probable cause before you're doing a search and seizure of evidence on someone. So this is persistent surveillance that is constantly collecting information, whether or not someone's committed a crime. And when I went into Scarsdale to cover the story, there were a lot of people in the area, and I grew up nearby. It's the same all over the tri-state, where there's a lot of people who are landscapers who are from other countries. And there were a lot of people who came to the village board and said, 404 Media has reported that they're giving this data to ICE so that they can track immigration cases and track people they're suspecting of being illegal immigrants that they want to take. They've also used this data to track people getting abortions across state lines. So it's not so much about Scarsdale. It's about establishing a national network in case someone happens to drive through Scarsdale that they want data on.
But the national network piece, I think, is important, right? Like the fact that these local municipal police departments don't have to go through a process of, say, collaborating with X county to pursue a specific case essentially makes it so that there's kind of this like privatized, almost federal surveillance aspect that can be tapped into legally by these municipal police departments. I mean, that's fairly unprecedented, I would imagine. Also, because, like, say if you were to collaborate with the federal government and they had that kind of information, that would be a more formal process, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've now started to sort of pivot how they establish their camera network and grow their camera network. They have 5,000 cameras cameras in 5,000 communities. It's over 88,000 cameras in 49 states. So they're already all over the place. But because now people are starting to push back at the municipal level, they started this thing called the Thriving Cities Fund, where they pay for private businesses to put their cameras on their property. So what does it mean for our democracy if those cameras are street view facing and then law enforcement gets access to them through Flock directly or the private business? So that's what we're dealing with, is they're amorphous. They're willing to use any avenue to put their cameras up. What does it mean in terms of antitrust law if they're going to pay for their own expansion as a company to put cameras everywhere? Anyone can buy license plate reading cameras. But what Flock offers that's unique, I would say, is the national network that you can track people across state lines, wherever they happen to go.
Let's talk about that national network, but I also want to get to that sort of like no bid process that you'd covered in Scarsdale, because that seems important to me too. But do we have a sense of how networked these are throughout the communities? Like, I mean, obviously within the context of the community, all the cameras are networked, but has Flock begun to build a national database that would allow for the feds just to be sitting in DC and sort of tracking somebody going from, you know, I don't know, from New England to Arizona or something?
So we know, because there have been cases of this happening. In the case of Johnson County, Texas, a sheriff was able to search the 88,000 camera network because they subscribe to this model where if they share their data with other Flock municipalities, they get access to search those cameras. And so they were tracking a woman who crossed state lines to receive an abortion. This became a major case. They searched cameras in states like Illinois, where abortion is legal, to prosecute this case. So what does that really mean? I mean, we know that ICE has accessed these cameras before. There's been cases in Westchester County, actually, where federal officials access the data. And when Flock is questioned about this, you know, are you collaborating with the federal government? They say, well, it's not our data. The data belongs to the towns. So what happens if they get a subpoena? They give a really unclear answer where they say, well, Scarsdale, we'll let you know that we've gotten the subpoena so you can protect yourself. And maybe you can ask us if you don't want us to fulfill the subpoena for the data with the federal government. But we deal with this on a case-by-case basis. So they answer like a politician, even at a time when they were pitching Scarsdale for the contract. And the village board was asking these very specific questions around who owns the data, can the federal government access it? They were given indirect answers. And Scarsdale still ended up authorizing the contract. So that's what we're dealing with here, is a lot of municipalities that are totally fine with accepting the potential consequences of now the federal government has a mass surveillance network they can access with whatever subpoena they can get.
And there was an angle about competitive bidding as well for this stuff. Tell us about that. Because, I think it's probably, I'm just a little jaundiced when I think about this, but it sounds to me like a bunch of police chiefs are getting kickbacks. Like, and I like, you know,
well, more bang
chief,
for your buck. Yeah.
Chief Anderson, you know, we'll explain the technology to you on a 5-day junket to Bermuda or something.
It feels like that. I mean, Chief Del Bene in Scarsdale was not the police chief when he started communicating with Flock. The first day he was appointed as police chief was the 14th of January. On January 15th, he was exchanging emails with a Flock representative to begin drafting up this contract. He didn't officially take office until the 1st of February. So what's going on here? He wasn't even the official police chief of the town. So you really wonder, yeah, what's at play? What's in it for him? There is a revolving door between people in law enforcement and people who end up working for Flock. How much of a salary bump are they getting if they end up signing a contract before they go on to take a job at Flock? I've asked, you know, the Flock communications director about this directly. And she said, this is entirely above board. You know, law enforcement officers have really good backgrounds and their experience serves them well at Flock. And so it's very suspicious. I don't know what's really going on, but you're supposed to have a request for proposals from a lot of different surveillance technology companies if you want to adopt a multimillion-dollar contract, because you want to get the best deal. You want to make sure you're picking the best technology. That didn't happen here, and it didn't happen in a lot of other cases where Flock sends a sole source justification letter, which says you don't need to do a competitive bidding process because we're the only company that offers this technology. So that's not true. Motorola has AI-powered license plate reading technology, but they don't have the national network that's established. So that really has to be the selling point. And the same sole source justification letter that was in possession in Scarsdale has been sent and then posted publicly in municipalities across the country. So it seems pretty clear that they have a model for doing this without public input, without recognition, with as little accountability as possible.
And that's where I think some of the antitrust liability lies there. Outside of applying antitrust issues, I guess, on that, you know, theoretically a different DOJ or a different FTC could bring. Are there other, is this in any way regulated by like states, or are there federal regulations, or is this just something that's like, it sort of feels a little bit like when Uber first started, they just would come in and create facts on the ground essentially, and then just apologize later.
Yeah, we all really miss Lena Khan right now. But I think in the case of Norfolk, Virginia, the Institute of Justice is funding a lot of lawsuits around Fourth Amendment concerns. So people who say the cameras block me in my neighborhood, I can't leave without being on one of these cameras. You shouldn't be collecting evidence on me if I haven't been convicted of a crime. And so it's been approached from that perspective legally, something people are doing to sort of waste law enforcement's time and make the cameras not worth it to have, is do a ton of FOIL or FOIA requests for whenever they drive past a Flock camera to get access to that data. And the courts have ruled that people are allowed to have access to those public records. It's not protected by any sort of laws. Scarsdale has tried to say that it would be a risk to public safety because we're investigating active crimes. So I don't know if the cartel of the Suns has roots in Scarsdale or what that's supposed to mean, but it sounds like that's not going to hold up in court and that people really do have access to these records. So I am happy to see it's got people with money willing to sue the government over Fourth Amendment concerns. And Eugene, Oregon is another place where they're pushing back against this pretty hard from some other angles. They've gotten several towns, including Scarsdale, to cancel their contracts altogether. So it's heading in the right direction, I think, now.
Jessica Burbank, investigative journalist, contributor to DropSite News. We'll put a link to both your YouTube documentary on this and the piece you've written. Really appreciate you coming on and talking about it.
Thanks, y'all. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Kay Sabeel Rahman, author and professor of law at Cornell Law School, will be here to talk about the Third Reconstruction. We'll be right back. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a real pleasure to welcome back to the program Kay Sabeel Rahman, author, professor of law at Cornell Law School. We had him last on in 2017 for Democracy versus Domination. And you've written a new piece, the Case for a Third Reconstruction in Dissent magazine. I love this piece. In many respects, it's sort of like what our mission statement has been here, particularly during this era, is to, A, fight the rising authoritarianism, kleptocracy, I mean, fascism. We can go on and on. Totally. And also to sort of set up for a new normal, because returning to the old normal does not work. But let's just start with just the concept of a third reconstruction. Lay out for us the other two reconstructions.
Yeah, great one. First, thanks for having me back, Emma and Sam. It's great to be with you and really appreciate this space you all have been curating. I think this is exactly the challenge for all of us. So I think the punchline for me is that we should be thinking about this moment as equivalent in transformative potential and urgency to previous moments of building our democracy. So the first Reconstruction, of course, was after the Civil War. And that's when I would argue we first actually started to become a multiracial, inclusive democracy, abolishing slavery, passing the 14th Amendment, and so on. But the other moments are, I think, one, the New Deal, responding to industrialization and the transformations of modern capitalism. And then the second Reconstruction, which is really the Civil Rights Movement. And that period of time in the 60s where you start to see greater inclusion on race, on gender, on a whole host of other things that really expanded the New Deal promise and other 14th Amendment promises to the whole country for the first time, Voting Rights Act, all of that. And thinking about this moment as a next reconstructive moment, like the New Deal, like the moment in the 60s and early 70s when we actually started to create the kinds of institutions and norms and values at scale that actually made us an inclusive and equitable society.
The I mean, it's interesting because when we look at what like some of the lowlights are of this administration, it's an assault on citizenship and all that's involved around that with immigration, yeah. Which, of course, the first Reconstruction was very much about the 14th Amendment and the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. That's what our society is based upon today. Virtually every Supreme Court case involves, not every, but close to it, one of those amendments. The Department of Education, the first Department of Education we had federally, was in the first Reconstruction. That is the first agency that they really went after to completely demolish, because, of course, that was the idea of like citizenry comes from a guarantee of education for everyone. There's so many parallels here with that. But let's talk about like the just going through the piece, the policy changes that we have seen more specifically, you put them into sort of you say that they have two features. What are those two features that the policy changes that we're seeing under the Trump administration?
Yeah. And I think you started us off, laid it out well, going back to sort of the reaction against the New Deal and the 14th Amendment. I mean, I think of this is not conservatism, right? We have a lot of different views in the country about, you know, role of government and all of that. I really think of this administration as offering a reactionary vision of society that is specifically built to try to undo advances of economic, racial, gender, geographic expansions of democracy, right? And so they're doing that by one, dismantling a whole host of things, right? Whether it's food stamps and the SNAP in the shutdown, you know, the dismantling of the Department of Education, the dismantling of FEMA, right? There are all these firing of the civil service. So there's a bunch of dismantling happening, which is all on the things that are essential for inclusion and for democracy, right? Those are the things they're breaking apart. And at the same time, there's a weaponizing of government to leverage the worst kinds of government coercion, whether it's ICE snatching people off the street in broad daylight, or using the coercive powers of the Department of Justice or Title VI to go after universities and firms and nonprofits, right? So it is both of these things happening at the same time, too much state power and a dismantling of state power. And the through line for me is that there is a coherent vision of a deeply hierarchical society in the economy and in society, and that's what connects those two things. And so thinking of this as a reconstruction moment, I think also helps make clear what we're up against, right? It's not just the normal deregulationists, you know, on the right. It's that, and it's this weaponizing authoritarian piece that together is trying to set us back, you know, before the Civil War, really.
But that scale, I think, is what you are trying to get people to grapple with your piece, right? I mean, what I loved that you wrote about here is talking about how returning to the pro-democracy coalition and flipping the lights back on is not going to save us here. Can you just expand on how the coalition that the opposition party has built, the Democratic coalition, how that's been insufficient since Trump's rise in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, one way to think about this, and look, there are a lot of important policy wins, that things that changed in the early part of the 2020s. We can talk about that. But, you know, we've already had one bite at the post-authoritarian, post-Trump apple, and we're back here in a worse position, right? So, you know, lots of people worked extremely hard to get us out of the 2016 to 2020 period, and some good policy resulted. But I just think, proof is in the pudding. We're in a worse spot now, right? And part of that, I think, is the insufficiency of transformation that happened from 2021 to 2024, right? We didn't have enough sort of bottom-up pressure to get the kind of transformative democracy reforms, for example, that could have headed off the gerrymandering war happening right now, the kind of deeper transformations of our economy to really speak to people's economic insecurity and exploitation and precarity in a world of growing corporate power, right? There were a lot of important things that started to happen at the FTC and elsewhere, you know, during the Biden administration. I really support a lot of that. But we needed still more. And so I think this idea, to your point, Emma, for me, we shouldn't be retreating from some of our big aspirations for what a good society looks like. We should be doubling and tripling down, because actually, to me, the lesson is we didn't do enough collectively. And that's why we're back in this mess.
I mean, there's certitude. It's the mess we're in is times two at this point, because it's the proof was in the pudding, like you say, in terms of the insufficiency of the Biden agenda to stop this wave of reactionaryism that has been building in the country, I would argue, for at least 25, 30 years, maybe going back to Reagan, frankly, for that matter. But and then what we're seeing in this iteration of the Trump administration is far greater assault on the structures of yes. our government. I mean, speak to that, because you write a Reconstructionist approach to policy may seem uncomfortable or excessive in some circles. But in this moment of authoritarian crisis, there are three reasons why we need it. You talk about the depth and scale of the attack on our institutions, the failure of pre-existing institutions, the Supreme Court, and then structural changes that we're seeing within the context of our government. Just talk about those aspects before we get on to how we respond.
Yeah, no, I think that's great, because in some ways we're hamstrung by a set of structures that are built to restrain the kind of democracy that we want to see come into being, right? So this, you mentioned the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court is in many ways downstream of the Senate and the Electoral College, which, you know, we have layers upon layers of counter-majoritarian institutions baked into our Constitution, number one. Number two, you mentioned the Reagan Revolution, Sam, that in a lot of ways part of what we've been laboring under for many decades is a set of policies and ideologies that have created a presumption against an expansive safety net, against attempts to rein in corporate power or lift or build worker power, right?
The antitrust regime that we've been living with for up until the Biden administration was an innovation, if you will, during the Reagan years.
Totally.
Prior to that, it was actually effective.
Totally, right. So the kind of Reagan-Bork revolution on antitrust that really undid the kind of New Deal era set of views about the need for a democracy to have corporate power be restrained enough for and wealth to be restrained enough for that for democracy to be real, right? So these are all just baked into our day to day of governing and the air we breathe in policy circles. And many people have been arguing against that and trying to push beyond that. But those put a low ceiling on what is actually possible in terms of transformation. And so part of the ambition I think we need at this point is, yes, there are some good policies we can point to from the last, you know, different waves of progressive governance, but we're going to need to get to those root structures of who has power in the economy, who has power in our politics and in terms of the rising authoritarian power, and alter that balance of power. And that's going to require very different institutions. And so it really puts us in the spirit, not of saving a democracy that was great, you know, 2 years ago or 10 years ago, but we should be thinking of ourselves as democratizers. We are having to create a democracy that hasn't yet been real for many, many Americans and many of our fellow Americans. And so that's the spirit, I think, when I think of Reconstruction, to me, that's what's empowering about that frame. It's thinking like, before there was a New Deal, what would we imagine to rein in corporate power? Before the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act passed, what would we need to do to have a genuine multiracial democracy? That's the mentality I think we should have.
And let's talk just a little bit about what were the material answers to those questions. Like, when we say what democratizes things, you know, prior to the New Deal, that's the National Labor Relations Board. That is Social Security Administration. That is, you're right, the Federal Trade Commission. These are all entities that are essentially function to distribute political power in some fashion or another, either by, you know, very often by material needs, providing for material needs, or providing for negotiating power, or inhibiting, you know, monopolies that are accruing and concentrating power. All of these institutions function to create essentially more democracy. And those are the type of things we need to be thinking about for the response to this era.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, democracy for me it's not just voting. I mean, there's an assault on that too, but, it's actually this deeper thing that each of us are equal moral persons, and we want a society that treats each of us with that equal dignity and respect, that enables us to thrive and live the lives that we might have reason to value, regardless of race, gender, sexual orientation, disability, geography, structural conditions that you might be under, you know, in terms of working conditions or economic insecurity, right? So that's if that's what democracy is, then I think the alphabet soup of the New Deal is actually a big part of this, in that we have these big aspirations and values. We should be forthright and unapologetic about the kind of society we want, but then we make it real by creating new laws and institutions, right? Without an FTC, it's really hard to gain leverage on corporate power that is exploiting small businesses and small towns and workers. Without an NLRB, it's really hard to enable and empower workers to unionize and demand their rights. Without Title VI, before, you know, the real Title VI, not this administration's version of Title VI and the Civil Rights Act, it's really hard to desegregate the country. And so we actually need an institutional source of power to advance the moral vision of democracy that we all want to see happen.
Well, when you talk about just like the institutions and how to create those, I just think it's important to linger on that for just a little bit, because you mentioned like the CFPB as being, you know, a step in the right direction, right? But a lot of this has to come from the legislature. And I think like that's another key element that we should be pointing out here. You know, you write about how the legislature has been central in the past to moments of democratization. You talk about the Reconstruction Amendments. You talk about how the New Deal in many ways was associated with FDR being a very strong leader, but that the legislature played a very important role. You would need that to create these administrative agencies that we're talking about. But then when we let's contrast that with the Supreme Court for a second and like how undemocratic that institution has been for decades at this point. And if you could just give us some historical analysis about the role of the legislature in moments of democratic expansion versus the role of the Supreme Court and the courts when they've asserted their power and how that has played out in American history.
Yeah, I so appreciate that, Emma. I mean, and going back to the first Reconstruction, I think is really illustrative here. So in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, all of those amendments to the Constitution have this really important line at the end of each of them where it says, Congress is the body that has the power to implement and make real the abolition of slavery, equal protection of the laws, due process of the laws, all of the stuff in those amendments, but a right to vote. And that was intentional because the notion was Congress is the seat of democratic sovereignty. I like to tell my students in constitutional law, it's Article I for a reason, right? And what you see happen after the passage of those amendments is a flurry of legislation that, you know, going to Sam's earlier point, creates the Freedmen's Bureau, creates the enforcement acts that allows local prosecutors to ring up Klansmen on charges of conspiracy to intimidate Black voters. And that legislation starts to create civil rights and affirmative, you know, economic affirmative economic investments. That creates the real on the ground reality, right, of equal citizenship for a brief time. And then it's actually the Supreme Court that goes out of its way to neutralize each of those statutes in the late 1870s and 1880s. And that helps usher in the Jim Crow era. So this, the whole puzzle of like, why does it take a century between the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement? It's because actually the Supreme Court, working in tandem with paramilitary groups in the neo-Confederate South, deliberately rolled back the democratic promise of Reconstruction. And you can tell the same story over and over again, right? The Supreme Court is in the way of labor organizers in the 1920s, you know, fighting for minimum wages and basic standard safety standards in the workplace. Over and over again, you see this pattern. And so to me, that's indicative, right? That Congress actually, as the most small D democratic body, we should have a conversation about like campaign finance and gerrymandering and voting rights. But the way our system was designed originally is for Congress to be able to lead and for the court to take a back seat. And on the executive power piece, I think this is something for progressives to actually really wrestle with. And, you know, I've served in the executive branch, so many other people have done great, great work. But I think we can get over-reliant, even as progressives, on the notion of a singular president who is going to solve everything. And we need that leadership, absolutely. And we need majorities in Congress who are going to legislate to create the big new systems that you're alluding to, Emma.
So there's really two parts. There's almost the third part of the Reconstructionist strategy, which is to sort of like be conscious of the meta, the meta process and you know the inhibitions to democracy that are built into our system. The second the one that's sort of like sandwiched in the middle there is constraining reactionary power and backlash, which I guess in Reconstructionist terms is like, guys, why didn't you continue to occupy the South? like, why did you leave it up to, why didn't when in South Carolina, when they're killing black politicians and driving them out of town, why weren't we sending federal troops in there to stop them? There's a bit of that in that sort of second strategy.
Yeah, I think this we've talked about the building and the democratizing. I think on this containing reactionary power, I think this has a couple of dimensions. And
like this get rid of ICE, would be
100%, right? So I think like, you know, in a world where even the Bill Kristol's of the world are very clear about that needs to happen, I think progressives should be even more clear, unapologetic that when there's a governmental institution that is systematically, flagrantly violating the rights of just basic human rights, let alone like laws on the books and, you know, mistakenly detaining U.S. citizens, but just in terms of the treatment of fellow humans, is just offensive and dangerous for a democracy, cannot continue, right? And so this, for me, the idea of containing reactionary power is meant to say that in any Reconstruction moment, it's not enough to just do the affirmative things that we want, right? We want a more equal economy, we want more democracy. We also have to like be real that there are centers of power that are built to prevent democracy. And so that, and we can think of that in terms of ICE, we can think of that in terms of, you know, we have laws on the books to prevent the kind of rank corruption that we're seeing in this administration and the kind of abuse of office, right? If someone is holding office and abusing that office for their personal gain or to violate the rights of others, like we have laws already on the books against that kind of behavior. I would put actually anti-monopoly and antitrust and corporate power in this domain as well. Like if you think one function that the Sherman Antitrust Act, when it was originally conceived, was to put a ceiling on how much corporate power could be amassed on the theory that any kind of unaccountable power at scale is just hostile to democracy, whether that's the unaccountable power of the oligarch or the unaccountable power of a government that does not respect basic democratic protections. So all of that is a like dismantling that we need to do as progressives to ensure democracy. Sorry, Emma.
It's important to note that economic piece, because I think when we just return to the failures of the so-called pro-democracy coalition, there has not been an effort from the opposition party to treat economic empowerment as a function of like democracy as well. When people don't experience that in their day-to-day lives, the most material way that a supposed democracy should be impacting them, they lose faith in those institutions in and of themselves. And then we have an opposition party that runs on faith in the institutions that are screwing you. And I just to zoom out in terms of a political orientation for the Democrats, like it's so fatal given everything you outline.
Yeah. And I think the notion that we actually have a very rich alternative tradition of progressive, small d democratic social change that is very clear about that democracy has to be real in a material sense, right? That people's basic rights have to be actually protected from a civil rights, human rights standpoint, that the economy has to actually be equitable. I mean, going back to, you know, the civil rights movement itself had a very robust vision of economic rights that was part of the March on Washington. And going still further back, the first Reconstruction also had an economic dimension to it. They weren't fully realized, but you know, from the standpoint of Black liberation and sort of advancing a multiracial democracy, social movements have consistently been very clear on the left, right, that the material reality of democracy has to be part of the equation. It's not enough to just sort of wave the flag of rule of law, right? And I think that's still a lesson we should be learning today.
And you write a lot about this, that much of this must come from a bottom-up movement. You cite it happening in the past. and that we need to be have at the ready plans for reimagined institutions that will make democracy real and durable going forward. And again, when we're talking about democracy here, this is not some type of like idealistic notion of democracy. It is one. It is literally a material people and sharing in power, which means that they get material benefits of society as well. What and you mentioned this is going to happen piecemeal. And, you know, Mamdani may be an example in one area and maybe in Montana where they are trying to say that if we charter your corporation, one of the rules of chartering a corporation in Montana is that you can't spend money on politics. Like that's just like any other rule about being a corporation. How do we compete with those entities, the moneyed interests that want to simply shift the power from column A to column B.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, you know, specifically, you know, like there's a Project 2029 that like Larry Summers at one point, I think was like sitting on the board and stuff like that. Now
our fearless leader into the future, Larry Summers.
I imagine he's not going to be anymore, but
one hopes.
but there's still going to be others. And so, like, and frankly, the abundance movement, it seems to me, was an attempt by a lot of those same people and maybe some of the wealthy oligarchs who are sort of like have control of this administration, too, to sort of like be the, you know, hedge their bets on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. How do we who don't have that monopoly of wealth, that concentration of wealth, the hold of big institutions. How do we, where does that come from in these instances? Like, you know, there was in the first Reconstruction, there were the radical Republicans.
Yeah.
I don't really see the analog to that today.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think it's a huge challenge. I mean, one thing I do think is really, source of optimism is, you know, we've seen the largest nationwide grassroots mobilizations in recent history this year, right? Thinking about the drumbeat of No Kings mobilizations, even at the hyper local level, thinking about communities that are organizing to protect their neighbors against attacks from the government, right? At block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood level, you know, people are trying to protect their fellow residents from ICE raids and so on. So on the one hand, I think we're seeing a tremendous amount of energy in small d democratic ways at the grassroots. And the challenge has been, how do we get more of our political leadership to channel that and help amplify that, right? I think you're seeing some of this in the states and in cities, right? You mentioned Mamdani in New York, thinking of places like Seattle, you know, New Mexico creating universal childcare, right? There are things that are moving in the states and in the cities that are pointing a way forward. That's number one. Number two, I do think we need more national leadership in the House, in the Senate, that are unapologetically building towards championing this kind of a reimagining of our democracy, right? And I imagine we will see a lot more of those kinds of voices clamoring for a seat at the table going into the midterms, you know, thinking about some of the different primaries in different parts of the country and so on. So, but we need a lot more of that. And then I think the last part to your point about, you know, there's always money at play and there's always, it's very easy for organized interests to launder their policy preferences through, you know, New York Times profiles and think tanks and the like. But what I'm really interested in is what are those organic spaces for designing and imagining new institutions, right? So some of the movement organizations that are partnering with, you know, more progressive think tanks that are embedded in social movements and that are working with grassroots partners directly, you know, a lot of this will be at the community level as well and generating new people running for office and kind of just new blood on the progressive side, I think will be really, really important. I do think a lot can change very quickly. So I'm still an optimist about where this can all go. You just think about the sheer brazenness and and danger that so many communities are experiencing under this administration. The notion of just a putting the old stuff back and tinkering around the edges is not going to be tenable anymore, right? I just don't think the public will buy it, right? Yeah. That's not where people are very clear about what's happening. So this is partly, I think, a wake-up call as for kind of political leadership to get either get more bold or get out of the way.
Get out of the way.
My just last question really quickly on this is just because when we're talking about corporate power and how these moneyed interests can influence our elections, you know, Zoran Mamdani, the most underrated story about his victory is the fact that he was able to be competitive with Andrew Cuomo because of New York City's matching funds program.
Yes,
and when totally. I think, like, when we are talking about systemic changes and how do we create the power that we need, it feels like we've got to start there with campaign finance reform. And it doesn't seem very likely at all at the federal level right now, but other areas of the country getting very serious about creating programs like this so that candidates who aren't, you know, raking in millions of dollars from billionaires can be competitive in those races. Like, I don't know. I want to do all of these structural things, but we have to have the horses first.
Chicken and egg.
Yeah. But to me, this really hard. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree with that, Emma. And I think it's things like the public financing in New York. Ranked choice voting is also something I'm really interested in. But we do need these structural changes that create more space. It does become a bit chicken and egg, to your point, Sam. But very quickly, one bit of hope maybe is going back to the progressive era in the 10s and 20s, pre-New Deal. Part of what's fascinating to me about that period is you see all of this is happening at the same time. Right? They are also worried about the oligarchs, the Elon Musks of that period, who can just drop tons of money and try to buy races and rank corruption and corporate power and all the rest. But what you actually start to see is at the same time that workers are organizing in new ways, that kind of municipalities are starting to create kind of public utilities and sort of sewer socialists of the era, you're also seeing campaign finance reform, the creation of ballot referenda at the state level. Mm-hmm. All these structural democracy changes are happening at the state and local level, simultaneous to changes in worker power, changes in economic power and governance. And it's because they also were facing the same chicken and egg problem. So that's not a formula, but I think it's a source of optimism or source of inspiration that we also need to do both of these at the same time. And to me, that means press on all fronts with maximum energy and see which things break first and then build on those, right? Rather than sort of like trying to get really small and think, well, maybe we'll put those issues to the side and only focus on this, right? We should be doing all of the things all the time and see what breaks first in our favor.
Kate Sabil Rahman, the piece is the third Reconstruction in Dissent. We will put a link to that, and we'll also put a link to Democracy versus Domination. Still very important work. I think about our that book and our interview often. It's surprising to me just because I tend not to be able to remember anything. But
I appreciate that a ton, Sam and Emma. Great to be with you all, and look forward to the next time.
Great.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
All right, folks. That's it for the free show today. We will head into the fun half where we will have fun and look at some clips of stuff. We've got all sorts of different things that we will get to.
We'll circle back to Trump falling asleep and that insane cabinet meeting.
That was really nuts.
Yeah. Not looking good for him. I mean, like, with all the Biden auto pen stuff, did Biden ever fall asleep in public? Oh, he did? Okay, yeah. Okay. He was also just let in public so much less than Trump. There you go. Yeah.
That was pretty impressive. And you know what? We'll cover this, but my favorite part was that both Rubio and Hegseth, who were sitting next to him on either side of him, I feel like they got more animated as a way of trying to wake him up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They both got really, really animated. They were talking like this.
Yeah.
Actually, splash water on his face.
Like at one point, I really thought they would go like, you know what I'm saying? and just like knock them like that. But
yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Wait, what time? What? Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member. Join themajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercial, but you also get the fun app. And send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Tell us what you think is the best of this year. And we will include it, maybe, I'm not going to promise anything, in our compilation of best ofs at the end of the year when we go on a vacation. It's the only time of the year where we're all on vacation at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Because we go on the workers' trust retreat.
Right.
That we go on.
Yeah. That's when he says vacation. The three of us are all just scrubbing the studio with a toothbrush. That's our. Right. That's what.
That's part of the trust.
We get.
That's part of the trust exercises that we do. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, 30% off right now. You try the coupon code majority, but I'm not even sure you need that. 30% off from justcoffee.coop. Try the Majority Report blend. Or try some of their single origin, or try both. 30% off. Now's the time to do it. You can buy a 5-pound bag of beans. I mean, that's the way I operate. Matt.
What did Brian want to say? I almost made a Jack and the Beanstalk joke and then realized it's...
Brian's watching.
And Brian was watching. Yeah.
I've got a serious Majority Report filter. We're still dialing in my filter here. Sometimes I think of things and I go, nah, not this show.
Not this show. Okay. Matt!
Oh, sorry. I was looking for the Elon make comedy illegal thing. Yesterday on Left Reckoning... I talked with Devin Thomas O'Shea about my favorite new novel by Thomas Pynchon called The Shadow Ticket, which everyone should look into. But I would say Wayward Young Men. It follows a guy from Milwaukee who, after high school, gets into strike breaking in the 30s and 20s because it's the best job that he can get with the gas in his car. And then eventually he softens up and... has a bunch of adventures, but check out that episode because if you are a literary type.
See you on the
other side.
Fun half. Three months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Unpacked. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked.
Matt.
Who?
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this?
7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports.
We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go throw up.
Ooh, libertarian.
They're so stupid, though. Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
Folks. It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out.
I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back. We are back. I was reading... This guy, somebody, Sam's Subaru said, why did you blur out the Sebade? And I was reading that
censorship
as I was saying, yeah.
What?
We are back.
In the fun half and the way we pronounce certain things in certain ads.
Oh.
Yeah, we have to do that to stay on the good side of the YouTube gods.
We are Bork.
We've been Borked.
We are Burks has a different meaning to British people.
Oh, is that what you said? Burks? Burks?
We are Burke.
What does it mean in the UK?
The C word.
Oh, really?
Oh, jeez.
You Burke. But it's like an affectionate way to call somebody the C word.
We are all Burke.
Well, so much for our British YouTube revenue this year.
All right.
I'm just making that up. All right, let's do this Trump cabinet meeting. He had this bat crap meeting yesterday. And understand the whole thing is set up for him to this is to sort of consolidate his image as being powerful, having people supplicate themselves to him, very much like literally almost like identical in the way that it's set up and shot to The Apprentice.
Yeah.
I mean, remember, he used to be sitting around a big conference table and the little, you know, interns would come in and blah, 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 blah. And then he would have to the left and right of him like
Gilbert Ivanka. Godfrey.
No. Next, on his side of the table, there was like Ivanka would sit there, or his like old timey business guy who I imagine now is in jail, and his like old timey secretary, and I imagine she's pled the fifth. And they would be on one side, and then all the sort of like stooges would be on the other side. And this is very much attempting to sort of recreate that. Yes. Yeah. Let's start off with him. This is 9-1. This is him basically speaking to, and we did. We did the cognitive test. Mm-hmm. I ran through it.
Flying colors.
Wasn't easy, though.
Listen, I did great. I did really, really good on the cognitive test. You weren't here.
I know.
I didn't even study for it.
You weren't here. But I did. It was completely sprung on me, and I did great.
Wow.
Like, no, I aced it. Believe me.
No other podcaster in history has taken it.
No one has ever dared to do it live on, like we did it. And I did great. And second only, of course, to Herr Trump.
We can never let another thing happen like what happened to us with a fake election, with a rigged election, where a guy like Joe Biden assumes the presidency, because the man was grossly incompetent. And he was incompetent 30 years ago, but he was really incompetent for those last few years. And our country was put in great danger because of it. So for 6 months in a row, we had zero people. Illegal border crossings along the U.S.-Mexico border have plummeted.
That might have been my fault. I did 2230, not 2030. So I got the end. I got the tail end of that. That's my bad.
Okay. We'll go to Matt needs to take a cognitive test.
Yeah. Can you, person, woman?
There he is.
One day where I didn't do a news conference, there's something wrong with the president. You people are crazy. I'll let you know when there's something wrong. There will be someday. That's going to happen to all of us. But right now, I think I'm sharper than I was 25 years ago. But who the hell knows?
By the way,
I took my physical. I got all A's, everything. But they said to me, would you like to take a cognitive test? I said, is it hard? They said, yes. I said, well, I'm a very smart person. Who was the last president to take one? No president has ever agreed to take one. Because when you get into the mid questions, meaning, you know, 10, question number 10, 11, 12, 28, 30, they get harder and harder.
It's true.
And they said, would you like to do it? I said, well, no reason to do it. Nobody's ever done it. I'll do it maybe, but there's really no reason. They said, sir, the problem is this is Walter Reed Hospital. And that's a military hospital. And that means that things are, you know, sort of open. It's not like private where you have, if you do poorly, we'll have to, probably you'll find out. I said, I won't do poorly. I'm a smart person, not a stupid person. And as the doctor will tell you, I aced it. Right, Susie? I aced. I got every question right.
Right, Susie. Mommy.
Right, Susie.
Right, Mommy.
These are questions that I would say 99% of the people that I'm talking to right now, meaning the people that, from the fake news, would not do well in those exams. But I'm the only one that took it. I got every single question right. And then I read in the New York Times, is Trump sharp? Trump is sharp. But they're not sharp. That's why they're going out of business, the New York Times. I hear that.
Oh, my God. This is so boring. Money, are we ridiculous. Good?
Okay. Now, there's a couple of things here. I find it really interesting. Hold on. Let's get to this in a second. I find it really interesting that he's saying maybe someday. It's, you know, like there is definitely like he's racing against the clock and he's a know of it. I mean, he knows that his day of reckoning is coming. But you should also know that a cognitive test does not necessarily measure how smart you are. It just measures whether or not your mental processes are working the way they should.
Right.
It's not like it's not a measuring to what degree you have intellect as much as is your intellect functioning the way, if you're a dim guy, are you still just being able to approach dimness in the way that you could before?
Well, and I don't know if it helps his case about how mentally sharp he is that he reverts to like high school and college grading systems when lying about what his doctor said.
He got an A. I got A's. Yeah. All A's.
You know, when you go to the doctor and you get A minuses or B pluses or, you know, that kind of thing.
I ran home from the doctor's office and showed Susie, look, all A's.
Oh, that's the other thing is we were joking about how Susie is like his au pair yesterday. And I mean, Susie, I did good on my test, yeah. Right? Tell look, mommy and look. Daddy. I can see them
good.
Just when I squint a little in the great beyond.
Now, this is the test I took, right?
Yeah.
And I did so well on this, right, Brian?
All
tell
A's.
Everybody.
All A's.
Yes, I perfect. Got all A's.
Sam is on. Sam and Trump are on
look,
the cognitive
just,
test
off
honor
the
roll.
Top of my head. Lion, rhino, camel. Now, a lot of people get confused because that camel only has one hump. And a lot of people are like, oh, I don't recognize the camel that says two humps, but I know exactly what it
wait,
is.
Wait, take it off the screen. Can you remember now, those animals there?
Yes, lion, rhino, camel.
I'd like to see Tim Pool do that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, a lot of times people are like, is that a tiger or is that a lion? But I know it's a lion.
Yeah,
you know.
Stupid people say that.
Because a lion is like the king. And lion has like a big crown of hair around his head.
They didn't even ask Obama to take this test because they knew he wouldn't pass it.
That's right.
Obama couldn't even tell. He's like, is that... he'd say, is that that's a tiger, an elephant and a llama? No.
Gazelle?
No. Nope.
He would have an unfair advantage, though, because he's from Africa, and they used all these African animals.
And even it's still, he'd still get it wrong.
It's biased towards Africa.
I'm so good.
Sam, you get you're in summa cum laude right now for your health. You must have had an uncle that went to MIT.
I didn't go into that fraternity. But my
passed the cognitive test and the MRI with honors.
All right, so let's move over to now. At one point, we played yesterday, like when Donald Trump was like full on sleeping, right? Yeah. We played that. So you have to know that everybody is aware at the table that Trump keeps falling asleep, and they're concerned about it, but nobody can say anything. Nobody's going to be the person to go like, "Mr. President, you're sleeping." And so here you see Hegseth, like, he's going to be very animated as he is trying to, as he's throwing his admiral around under the bus. He's 100% supportive of the thing that he didn't do. But it's not his responsibility.
I mean, I wish I could take credit.
Listen, exactly. I wish the buck stopped here. But unfortunately, he did. So, but here he is explaining. And look, for all you people who have never been in the Situation Room, you have no idea how crazy it is in there when you have the full force of the U.S. military bearing down on one fishing boat in the Caribbean. Go ahead.
Those are not Christmas gifts from Santa. This is drugs running on four motor fast boats or submarines that we've also struck. No one's fishing on a submarine. And I have empowered them to make that call. Now, the first couple of strikes, as you would, as any leader would want, you want to own that responsibility. So I said, I'm going to be the one to make the call after getting all the information and make sure it's the right strike. That was September 2nd. There's a lot of intelligence that goes into that, building that case and understanding that a lot of people providing information. I watched that first strike lock. As you can imagine, at the Department of War, we got a lot of things to do.
Positive. Okay. Now, listen, I don't get much sleep. And so I am so there with Trump falling asleep. Like, and he does it in a second.
When his eyes are open,
and
here,
see,
it's like...
You can see where he feels himself like, I'm falling, catching EK. He has to jerk his head back up. Like, his eyes are open 1 second, and then he's just, like, asleep the next second. Now, remember, and to be fair, he was out. He was doing that tweet storm at, like, what, midnight?
Yeah,
something
yeah.
like that. It was a two-hour tweet storm.
A two-hour tweet storm. And so he clearly could not sleep. And... you know, somebody had to take the phone away from him. It's not like he like fell asleep with the phone in his hand. Somebody had to take the phone. He had to calm down.
Susie.
This is a full half minute
Susie,
dose.
Susie limits my screen time.
Okay, so
Susie said I was good. I could be on Truth Social for 2 hours.
So you have to. I clean my room. And so I get to go on Truth Social. you have to both listen to Hegseth. Worm his way around. Now, understand, Hegseth has huddled with his attorney before he's given
right.
this. Yeah. So everything is like, he's saying like, you can hear him saying, I volunteered to take responsibility for this, even though I don't really have it. And I did it the first couple of times, not the subsequent times.
I'm not doing it
times,
anymore.
But yeah. I didn't do
for
it all.
For some
you
reason.
Know? And so
why have I changed tax?
I am trying to explain to you why it appears like I am in charge, but in that very moment, I was not. But I'm good doing it in a very roundabout way. Meanwhile, Trump is just like, okay.
Another side note is Pete also has to cover up his own drink from himself. That's how dangerous he is.
Oh, yeah.
No, I've had enough for today.
Right.
It's noon.
You'd think you could stay awake if your Department of Warhead is trying to defend himself from war crimes.
Boring.
own that responsibility. So I said, I'm going to be the one to make the call after getting all the information and make sure it's the right strike. That was September 2nd. There's a lot of intelligence that goes into that, building that case and understanding that a lot of people provided information.
Coming.
I watched that first strike line. As you can imagine, at the Department of War, we got a lot of things.
I didn't stick around
for the hour and 2 hours, whatever, where all the sensitive site exploitation digitally occurs. So I moved on to my next meeting. A couple of hours later, I learned that that commander had made the, which he had the complete authority to do, and by the way, Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat. He sunk the boat,
All right, pause it for a second. Just go back a frame. You can see he has got this piece of paper. He is trying to make it look like he's speaking contemporaneously, but there are specific words that his lawyer has told him he should be saying, and you can see him glance down to his paper to get it. Go back just about 20 seconds. Watch him correct. When the word correct, it's down there. He is being coached what to say. Correct is just an opinion, right? Like, I don't know the intricacies of this, but his lawyer definitely has a theory as to how he's going to protect himself. And so he is looking down at his paper as he's addressing everybody to make sure that he's saying the exact words that his lawyer has told him to say.
Yep, color in the lines, Pete.
Watch it.
Department of War, we got a lot of things to do. So I didn't stick around for the hour and 2 hours, whatever, where all the sensitive site exploitation digitally occurs. So I moved on to my next meeting. A couple of hours later, I learned that that commander had made the, which he had the complete
right there.
Authority
he
to
made
do.
That.
And by the way, Admiral
Bradley authority.
Made the,
and
made the, which he had the complete authority to do. And by the way, Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat.
And
he sunk the boat and eliminated the threat. And it was the right call. We have his back. And the American people are safer because narco terrorists know you can't bring drugs through the water and eventually on land if necessary to the American people. We will eliminate that threat and we're proud to do it.
Pause it for a second. Now, they keep referring to eliminate the threat as if there was a, as if these two guys floating in the Caribbean Sea represent a threat to the United States. Now, here's the thing that's going to be very hard for them to argue if we get a proper prosecution of them. If the threat is the transport of the drugs were sunk. These two men did not represent a threat.
Right, with the double tap. Say, even again, like this is the problem for them. When you grant their insane theory, this the double tap, the return to kill the survivors, is legally indefensible, even when you accept their premise that
it's not
we were
rules of engagement
already at war, right? In fact, it's literally illegal and codified in the United States not to conduct military operations in a way that is explicitly designed to say that there's no survivors.
They tried Nazis for this exact same thing.
Oh yeah, just right.
Nazis tried Nazis for
yes.
this thing.
Yeah. There's a historical example of it. Just Security's Ryan Goodman pointed this out. There was the Peleus World War II war crimes trial. There was 12 survivors on a Greek steamer when the vessel was sunk, and a Nazi naval officer essentially ordered for that vessel to be sunk, and then to kill those survivors. And then there were 5 German officers who were convicted of war crimes in reaction to that. And like we've talked a little bit about how the DHS tweets out things that are meant to be Nazi insignia. They're meant to, like, what, the 14 letters or whatever?
1488.
Yeah. I mean, they've done this multiple times. And then the remigration thing that we covered earlier this week, which is just, like, fascist rhetoric.
Yeah.
I think that Stephen Miller literally lifts from Goebbels, Goebbels, right? That's how you say
Goebbels.
It? Goebbels. I never know why. I have a tick in my head about that. And I genuinely think that they like think it's amusing to lift historical examples from the Nazis and use
them
in the modern day.
They did it well. All right, let's keep going here because this is the Hegseth has Hegseth is going to explain something that none of you penciled neck geeks can understand.
Cushioned lounge. To the American people, we will eliminate that threat, and we're proud to do it.
So you didn't see any survivors, to be clear, after that first strike?
I did not personally see survivors, but I stand because the thing was on fire. It was exploded in fire and smoke. You can't see anything. You got digital. This is called the fog of war. This is what you and the press don't understand. You sit in your air-conditioned offices or up on Capitol Hill and you nitpick and you plant fake stories.
Pause it for a second. I just want you to be aware that the office in which Hegseth sat when he said, kill these people, was an air-conditioned office on the Hill.
It could have been. Well, you know that.
You just don't get it.
I mean, when Washington, D.C. is foggy.
You don't. No. Yeah. It's fog of war when you see it on a screen.
Gotcha.
You guys have fog goggles on.
Yeah, you don't. It's called the pixelation of war.
Yeah.
Everything's pixelated.
Okay.
It's all blurry.
The fog of war, does that have any other meanings potentially?
Yeah, it's about pixelation.
Okay.
When there's a fire.
Okay.
That's the fog of war.
I mean, I understand when you're in combat and that's what people refer to as incredibly chaotic. That's the fog of war. Uh-huh. But if you're in an air-conditioned situation room, what could fog of war possibly mean?
I have a question.
Pixelation.
What if you had seen them, Pete? Like, what if you had seen
it was survivors? The correct decision.
Well, then, like,
that
what does it
somebody
matter?
Else made,
like,
not me.
You know, if you stuck around enough, didn't like jet off to like, I don't know, a happy hour, and you saw the people swimming in the water, what would you have said?
Oh, I.
What would you have authorized to do?
Yeah.
All right, just go back. Just listen a little bit more to the fog of war that Pete Hegseth claims existed because of the smoke in the TV monitor.
Yeah, that was 10,000 miles away from him.
Yep.
This is what you and the press don't understand. You sit in your air-conditioned offices or up on Capitol Hill and you nitpick and you plant fake stories in the Washington Post about kill everybody, phrases on anonymous sources not based in anything, not based in any truth at all. And then you want to throw out really irresponsible terms about American heroes, about the judgment that they made. I wrote a whole book on this topic because of what politicians and the press does to warfighters. President Trump has empowered commanders.
Now, pause it for a second.
Yeah,
I hope you caught what was going on there. He was saying that a lot of you are throwing around a really serious. He is referring to people saying that he, Hegseth, engaged in a war crime. But he is saying you're making aspersions about heroes. Other heroes. In other words,
those
like,
heroes he's, over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, like you're saying that they over there committed war crimes, and that's wrong for you to say that about them. I have nothing to do with it, of course. That's what he's doing there. He's already trying to sort of like position himself out of the line of fire here.
It's Trump saying, like, my speechwriter has some awful joke about J.B. Pritzker being a fat slob, and yeah. I wouldn't say that.
No. Yeah, right.
I wouldn't do that.
I like that Hegseth brought up his book, which was called The War on Warriors, if people want to check it out. But it's basically about how when he served in Iraq, he told the men under his command to ignore guidance from a military judge advocate, generals, JAG, attorney guidelines about the rules of engagement in conflict. A lot of his book is centered around the fact that these so-called war fighters shouldn't be limited by things like, you know, legal laws and things
pencil,
like that.
Pencil neck pushers.
Exactly. And during Trump's first term, Hegseth got on his radar by successfully campaigning for the pardon of two Army officers and the reversal of disciplinary measures on a Navy SEAL, each of whom were charged or convicted of war crimes. But apparently, we should take him seriously as he sits there and insists that they did everything in accordance with the law to protect America, when his whole political project that got him to this position when he was wholly unqualified for was literally arguing that our soldiers should not be bound by laws.
Maybe that's a reason why everyone is saying you shouldn't have just blown these people up in the first place. Maybe you should interdict the boats and find out what's on it because of this fog of war. Maybe people realize that, oh yeah, a satellite imagery of a motorboat is not enough to incinerate the entire people in that boat. Like, he's proving none of this makes any sense.
Well, you're granting you're being too generous with your, like, or I know you're not, but like, even in that interpretation, we know that what they had been trying to do was create a situation where they could have Venezuela respond to what they did as a pretext for a war against them and potentially a ground invasion, which we know they've talked about.
It still may happen.
Yeah.
But nobody's considered the fact that fog of war could actually just be the brand of whiskey that he drinks.
Yes. You know, I was trying to set that up earlier. All right. It is a cocktail, though. We looked that up,
yeah,
right?
It's got eggs in it.
Ugh. That's his breakfast.
That's how I get protein.
Yeah.
Yeah. Warfighters need protein.
Yeah.
Do we have any more of this, or should we move on to the next one?
That's really
cool. This part of the Trump press conference is very strange. A lot of people have a bunch of different interpretations. I am quite sure, as you know, I did take the cognitive test on air, which nobody else has done. No other podcast host would do it. Emma certainly wouldn't do it.
It's public. If you do it, if you do it bad,
she wasn't
it's
even here
public.
When I took that test.
Getting married, she was like, in Italy,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah,
when we did it.
Whatever it was.
Yeah, and I ran fleeing. From it. I ran from it.
Yeah, she was ran from me taking the cognitive test. Everybody did. Everybody ran. Nobody was even here on the equipment. But so I understand what Donald Trump is saying, because I for a long time, I lived in the same neighborhood as MIT, Central Square in Cambridge. And people, I would walk by people all the time. They'd say, "Do you go to MIT?" And I'm like, "No, I just live here." But they go, "Oh, I thought you went to MIT."
And then you're like, "How about them apples?"
Yeah, exactly. Anyways, here's Donald Trump. He is talking about how incompetent Tim Walz is. And then he says, he basically starts talking about how when J.D. Vance debated him,
right,
he was like, Walz must be incompetent because my incompetent guy is actually beating him. And then he starts to like ramble about Kamala Harris without naming her. This is what's going on.
We're at hour 2:13, by the way.
Of the cabinet meeting.
The cabinet, yeah. Christmas special.
Yeah, exactly.
That was bad. That was real bad. And they also sent drugs. Yeah.
On Tim Walz, Mr. President, do you think he should resign over the fraud scandal in his state?
And who should?
Tim Walz. Over the fraud scandal in his state.
Look, I think the man's a
great pause it for one second. I just like, there's, I'm sure you're going like, wait, what? What fraud scandal?
That's a great question.
That understand that everybody in that room is like from right wing media. So somebody from like, I don't know, town hall or a power line or whatever.
It's John from Dachau Weekly.
Yeah,
exactly. I got a question for you.
Red state.
So just understand, yeah, red state. I mean, so that's where that question came from.
Tim Walz over the fraud scandal in the state.
Look, I think the man's a grossly incompetent man. I thought that. From the day I watched J.D. destroy him in the debate, I was saying, who was more incompetent, that man or my man? I had a man and he had a man. They were both incompetent. And I had a man and a woman. I thought she was very incompetent, too. But now she's leading the field. And I think she's leading the field in this, in the nomination. Anyway, look, that's up to them. That's up to the Democrats. You know, the problem with them is they have really bad policy. And I'm not going to say what it is because I don't want them to change it necessarily. Because I want to run against it, whether it's not going to be me. It's going to be somebody that's going to probably sitting at this table. Could be a couple of people sitting at this table. Could be a couple of people running together sitting at this table, you know. But I want them to win because we've done a great job for this country and I want that to be carried forward. And, you know, I think we have a tremendous bench, really a tremendous bench. But, I think that Walz is a grossly incompetent.
Okay, so there's a couple of things here. He is, you follow what he's saying, right?
Like, yeah.
He's saying, I had a woman and a guy. He's talking about who he was running against. Mm-hmm. And he combined it, like, where he's, like, every, you have your chance
for everyone.
From his, exactly, from his perspective, everybody in the world is his. Like, right. He's like, you know, he's like the classic sort of like, you know, sophomore in college, super high, and goes like, what if this is all just a dream? Like, none of you people actually exist. You're just figments of my imagination. And that's right. The way he perceives
that's
everybody.
That's also sociopathy.
Yes, also that too. But what's interesting is he has basically conceded that not only will he not be running again, but that his, you know, they are actively talking about who's going to be the candidate, mm-hmm. which is early.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's 3 years from now, right? I mean, right? 3 years from now is when supposedly the 2028 election will happen. And yet they're already talking about who's going to, like he in his head already knows that there's two people in here and one of them's going to be the vice president and one's going to be the presidential nominee. And so, it seems early. He hasn't been in office for a year.
Well,
and he's already talking about.
Right.
That they have already walked through who's going to be succeeding him.
We saw that. That's why Vance was riffing on about the turkey the other day. He had to get himself out there.
But here's the other thing. Go back and listen to this again, because how do you know who's going to be the vice president? Like, presumably, there's going to be a primary, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe everybody clears the field for J.D. Vance, but I find that hard to believe. But they're already talking who's the vice president, which is super, super premature to be talking about that. Like, as if there's been some, like, talk of who would be the vice president, but that's not going to happen until after somebody wins the nomination. Unless there is a different strategy.
Jeff, this country, and I want that to be carried forward. I think we have a tremendous bench.
No, it's right before really that. Right before that. Just go back another 10 seconds.
Probably sitting at this table could be injured necessarily because I want to run against it. Whether it's not going to be me, it's going to be somebody that's going to probably sitting at this table. Could be a couple of people sitting at this table. Could be a couple of people running together sitting at this table, you know? But I want them to win because we've done a great job in this country, and I want that to be carried forward.
A couple of people sitting at this table are going to run together. Mm-hmm. That's weird. If this was Donald Trump's first term and he and J.D. Vance ran again, that would be normal. Just like it was, you know, when Biden and Harris were running. But it's weird that he's already speculating who's going to be the vice presidential nominee. Maybe they've worked it out and said, J.D. Vance, you know, Marco, don't run, and J.D. will definitely pick you as a VP.
Or Kristi Noem, maybe, too.
Or who knows? But it's weird that they've gotten that granular at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's what we were speculating, too, about J.D. Vance trying to go out there and look like he's one of the people. So, I mean, we don't know what's going on with Trump, but, what time in the calendar is it? Is it time for the injection?
No, it happens.
I think it happens on the 10th, right? Isn't that our little marker? He might be slowing down
it's
now.
It's almost like the cycle. So it isn't necessarily just on the date. It would come, let's see.
It's supposed to be like 4 weeks, right?
I have actually December 8th, I have Trump juiced. So we'll see.
That's what I'm saying. It's the third. He's
definitely not juiced here.
Not juiced right now.
Kenny,
and
a little woozy. I think it's time to connect old Donny Wani up to the machine and give me some of the.
That's the real fog some of the.
In a week, he'll be extremely manic. Just watch.
Yeah, and his hair will be dyed again. Look, his hair's going white again.
Oh, yeah.
That's the real fog.
Take me into the spa. Get the full treatment, please. let's go. This is part four. This is where Trump needs to get extremely disgusting. We should say that ICE announced that they're invading the Twin City area, and they are going after Somali immigrants. And, you know, this has always been Trump's go-to. Whenever he got in trouble in the past, it was always attacking somebody with a black or brown complexion.
Appeal to the Klan.
And this is a twofer for him because these folks are black and immigrants. So
I can say that about other countries, too. I can say it about other countries, too. We don't want them to help. We have to rebuild our country. You know, our country's at a tipping point. We could go bad. We're at a tipping point. I don't know if people mind me saying that, but I'm saying it. We could go one way or the other, and we're going to go the wrong way if we keep taking in garbage into our country. Ilhan Omar is garbage. She's garbage. Her friends are garbage. These aren't people that work. These aren't people that say, let's go, come on, let's make this place great. These are people that do nothing but complain. They complain. And from where they came from, they got nothing. You know, they came from paradise, and they said, this isn't paradise. But when they come from hell, and they complain and do nothing but bitch, we don't want them in our country. Let them go back to where they came from and fix it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, apparently I saw in the Times that that was J.D. Vance banging the table. I mean, just like clapping like a seal, basically, at that racist screed.
So disgusting.
Yeah. I mean, so he's obsessed with Ilhan Omar, right? He's obsessed with women of color, and she's his latest fixation. But yeah, he's mad that she has some critiques of the Trump administration and is flirting with the idea that she should be deported. We saw that, I guess it was this morning, there was reporting that they're already touching down in Minnesota. ICE is targeting Minnesota right now, right?
Yeah, and New Orleans.
Yeah, and New Orleans. There's 80,000 Somalis in Minnesota. They're mostly concentrated in the Twin Cities, and a majority of those Somali Minnesotans are U.S. citizens. It's like well over 80%. But still, let's send in ICE to terrorize these communities.
There'll be a lot of footage of fat guys slipping on ice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In Minnesota.
Not the right time to go there, I guess.
You know, like, my focus on fascists and white supremacists is, you know, the people at DHS that are doing all the 1488 sort of allusions and Stephen Miller and stuff like that. But the thing that, in my life, that made me think that fascism is a real problem that could have popular buy-in was in the Obama administration, looking at news articles about anything to do with the Somali community in Minnesota, and the amount of scum white supremacists from rural Minnesota and suburban Minnesota that would comment on that stuff, it sickens me. And it is a real huge submerged part of our country that we need to confront. And Trump, like you said, like whenever he gets into trouble, he appeals to those Klansmen.
I mean, the persistent rumor that you'll never stop hearing, this false smear of Ilhan Omar in particular, that she came into this country by marrying her brother,
was claimed by a actual convicted pedophile named Anton Lazaro that Tucker Carlson was using to try to look into that.
But Trump officials, by the way, still Trump said it in his latest screed about her on Truth Social when he talked about her hijab, just giving away the game there. It's just deep, deep guttural racism, and it seems to get worse with every year he ages.
Let's talk about some of the underpinnings of this ideology. We've spoken in the past, particularly in the first half of the year, quite a bit about Curtis Yarvin, who was the philosophical, I guess, is perceived as like the guru of Peter Thiel and probably for that matter, J.D. Vance. He would blog as a Mendacious Mulberg or whatever it was. Mendacious Mulbug. We spoke to Gil Duran we've talked about this guy before. Where did it all begin for him when he came up with this theory about how the U.S. needed a monarchy, really. I mean, a dictator, obviously, you know, a king, you'd need to have some like blood lineage for it to be a king. But it really is looking for a dictator. Right. And we've heard Peter Thiel many times talk about this era is very similar to the late 1920s in Germany, in Weimar Germany, where people were like done with communism, done with democracy, and were looking for something else. This is all part of a whole. And of course, J.D. Vance, weaned essentially by Peter Thiel. So let's find out. Let's go back to the origin story.
The intellectual origin.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is the origin story. This is like, you know, how Superman got shot from, you know, the planet Krypton, and how Batman lost his parents in that dark alley. And here's how Curtis Yarvin started his intellectual journey. Yes.
You know, it's like, actually, if I, you know, to describe the first moment in which I realized that, like, things were going to happen and history had not ended, was, it was like 2005 or something. YouTube was a new thing. And I saw this video. I'm sure it's long since disappeared, but it was really just like kind of burned a hole in me. And it wasn't even a video. It was actually just a sequence of photos sort of presented with a kind of slow animated zoom in, dissolve, sad piano music sort of over it. And the photos were in two sequences. So the, you know, the even photos and the odd photos all matched. And the even photos were sort of brightly colored pictures of just like general Western, you know, decadence, decay, rot, filth. You know, we've all seen these things. And then interspersed between them, formal dress portraits of Nazi officers. And I'm just like, you watch this thing, you're just like filth degeneration, bright, optimistic young man in Nazi uniform, filth degeneration, bright, optimistic young man in Nazi uniform. And you're just like,
coked up, man.
Yeah, that's the thing. And like, basically,
that's the coming thing.
It's a form because it's
basically, I mean, that's the reaction.
It's breaking in a way. It's just, it's a totally forbidden thing. And that you watch it and you're just like, wait a second, something's wrong here.
Yeah. Something is wrong. Look in the mirror, I think, if you want to find out where it's located.
I'll just say, this is the most coherent thing I've ever said, heard this guy said. He has no output that's at all worth referencing. Nobody references it. Like, he just does this sort of stupid thought bullshit. And people like Elon Musk or whoever like think he's actually smart.
It's also the most illuminating because it is that element of like, there's a secret transgression that's happening mm-hmm. here.
It's almost titillating.
I'm looking at this like it's like porno. Like, I'm not supposed to be looking at it. My parents don't know. And so much of this is like, it is the mentality of a 17-year-old boy who's like,
that's generous,
but he was in his 30s. Like, I just looked at his age. That's my point, just to see how like mentally weak someone like this
is. He was 32.
I mean, yeah. So there you go, and you were able to be propagandized by pictures interspersed in a Nazi YouTube video.
Maybe it's like a 12 or 13 or 14-year-old boy.
It would have been less embarrassing if you said you went to a magic show in Vegas and the guy got you to act like a monkey or something like that by using a code word. I mean, that's the level of intellectual like sophistication that we're talking about here. But he's also not being truthful. I'm sure he watched some garbage, naughty YouTube videos, and that really turned him on to think about the fact that he's engaging in such intellectual, scary, dark waters here.
So
but
taboo.
This is a lie about your origin story. Your origin story really is that a bunch of really rich guys thought that what you had to say to suck up to them was incredibly valuable because you empowered them to do the worst of their like surveillance technology and their most anti-democratic impulses, and you were subsidized and treated like some sort of thought leader without any having any kind of backing to it. As a blogger.
Yeah, you came up, like the thing, Peter Thiel was the same sort of thing. He wrote a book called The Diversity Myth with David Sacks before he made it big, betting in their speculative economy. All these guys are just clowns who made a right bet at the right time. And now we have to, because Yarvin has been bankrolled. Like, I'm pretty sure his businesses have gotten investment from all these Silicon Valley guys. Like, money allows bullshit to defy gravity. And I'm like, I'm almost annoyed at how much time I've spent in the last 10 years on this fucking loser, because it is, there's just nothing there. The Wizard of Oz, like, at least he was behind a fucking curtain.
But I mean, also, we just see too how the modern fascist movement is very much coming out of Silicon Valley. And you know, when we had Gil Duran on, people should still continue to read his Substack and all the work that he's publishing. I think he's working on a book too. But just the fact that, like, yes, we have the traditional Heritage Foundation types, and Project 2025 is very much an outgrowth of like the conservative right-wing project that we've seen for so many years. But it fits very nicely into this like newer form of this neo-monarchical kind of vision that he has been across, Yarvin, but has really just been a way to flatter the sensibilities and empower guys like Peter Thiel and Mark Andreessen, who want a privatized network state. They essentially want to be the heads of these sort of fiefdoms that are over-surveilled, and with them being in charge of said surveillance. And that is the way for them to like build their perfect kind of civilization. So it's just like we talk about the right and red states and things like this, but so much of modern fascism is coming right now out of very wealthy people in cities that want those cities to be basically kind of like cleansed of undesirables and used as testing grounds for mass surveillance across the country.
And the mass surveillance is going to be the way in which they do that.
Yep.
Did you guys get, Ed, it was working. Did you get in the interview with Jessica, did you get into Peter Thiel being an investor in Flock?
No. She mentioned it.
Oh.
And Andreessen.
Okay. Yeah,
the
yes.
PayPal Mafia was like the, yeah.
Yeah.
That backs all that up.
I saw this, I want to play this trailer for a really interesting film. I have not seen the film, but Miss Rachel was showed this. I think I saw it on Instagram. You remember the story? This was early on in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. There was the story of a young girl who I think like her, she was in a car with her family, and the car was bombed.
Yeah,
and the girl was stuck there. And she called, calling for help.
The Palestinian, Red Crescent.
And this is, it's number 12. And they have made a movie using the actual audio from the calls and integrated it into a sort of like
docudrama,
a recreation in some respects of the conversations. It is called The Voice of Hind Rajab.
Yeah.
And let's
just want to say to give a second on what the killing was. She was on the line basically with the dispatcher for 3 hours. She was a little girl saying, "I'm scared. Please come take me. Please, will you come?" And then the Israeli military killed her. This little girl. And she was among the wreckage of her family members. They were fleeing Gaza City at the instruction of the Israeli military. And she was there for hours amongst dead bodies and then was killed by the Israelis.
When those righteous Columbia students took over that hall, they renamed it after this girl.
It's going to be the film is going to be released in about 2 weeks on December 16th. But here's the trailer. Please don't leave me. I'm going to read it. I'm all alone. Mari, I need an ambulance. We need to guarantee a safe route. She doesn't have time. The tanks are here. They're shooting at me. See all the people? We've lost them all. Without coordination, those 8 minutes can cost them their lives. Please come.
They are shooting at a car with a little girl inside. Can you imagine that? So do something.
Save me. Are you in preschool? I'm in the butterfly class. We're coming to get you. Please don't leave me. I'm afraid of the dark. I guess coming out December 17th in theaters.
Such an awful, awful crime, that crime in particular.
One thing, Democrats need to, like Blinken, there needs to be war crimes. Like, we talk about, I like Grant Plattner talking about this stuff about Hegseth. People need to pay for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all those students that, like, you know, they were right. And the world needs to understand that they were right. And the people that were against them protesting and the campus administrators, shame on all of them.
You mentioned that, right? That in Columbia, that's what they renamed the hall, Hinz Hall, in response to her.
Should be officially renamed. And there should be an absolute cleaning of the stables there.
Yep. Reed and I am Mama Fistilies. Hey, y'all, sorry to send the IM again. There's an important action happening here in Texas to combat the anti-trans bathroom ban going into effect tomorrow. We really need to get the word out everywhere we can. It's called Bathroom Banarchy, and we're encouraging people around Texas to go to politicians' office and use the multi-occupancy restrooms there are to force the government to define an enforcement mechanism and potentially get an entire statute abolished in court. If you take calls today, I will call in from a 210 area code to talk about it. We probably will not. We got to wrap up early because...
Oh, we do?
Oh, yeah, a little bit because Brian's got to check on his dog.
Oh, really?
My dog's a little sick.
And, oh, no.
I mean, I'm excited right for Brian to get there and find diarrhea all over the place.
Yeah, that would mean that everything's been expelled. So
exactly.
All right.
That's probably the best case scenario.
Do you want to do 11?
Let's... I watched my 2025 YouTube Wrapped of YouTube content creators. I watched MR the most. MR wasn't mentioned in my Wrapped at all. Not even a channel avatar was shown when showing my most watched channels.
For Spotify?
Interesting. Skid Mark Twain.
Oh. That would be YouTube, I guess.
Yeah, I don't
YouTube
know what's
does
going
Wrapped?
On.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. I don't want to see my Wrapped.
Oh,
yeah.
After working here, my Wrapped is going to be so much like Donald Trump Jr. and shit.
Our algorithms are screwed.
Yeah, let's do this. California Resistance, Sam, the voice of Hind Rajab is playing at the Palm Springs Film Festival in early January. Dark Woke Wizard, have you discussed RFK Jr.'s erotic poetry? I think you should read some of it in his voice, Sam.
Yeah.
We talked about it a little bit, right?
I don't know if we talked about it on air, actually, because it's so gross.
It's disgusting.
I want my harvest to... We'll fill you up with my harvest.
Yeah, he says, you're my canyon and your river.
Bloodhound gang lyrics.
My canyon. F is for felching.
I don't know that term.
I didn't know it either until I read about it.
You've led a nice life, Emma. You've avoided that term.
That's his classic Christmas card stuff that he writes anyway, so. You get that. You get
why'd
that
I Google that?
You get all that with the Christmas cards.
Yuck! That's when I accidentally used reach around incorrectly. Do you remember that? That was like from like 4 years ago. I thought it was like a hug from behind.
Well, that's sort of what it is.
or something.
You just kept in a two-car garage for 30 years and then let out?
Yeah. Brian thinks I'm hopelessly naive.
I'm jealous, though. I think it's a great way to be. You don't want to be on this side of the street.
Brian will never get back there.
Hold on to that as long as you can.
Oh, gosh. Happens for Fauci, too. Yeah. Let's...
Yeah, come on. Come on.
God.
11, come
it's
on.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I would get this if she was out there trying to hawk some type of, like, reverse mortgage product.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I would get this if, like, she was... consciously aware of trying to manipulate boomers and greatest generation people, like, you know, people and sell some product to them. But the complete, I don't want to say naivete, because it's not, it's the delusion is what it is.
Yeah.
It's a delusion, and it's somebody in an incredible bubble. We are so deep into get off my lawn territory here that I honestly can't even express it. I just wish that she would find it somewhere in her heart to give the country a break and step back away from these events. Now, of course, she has every right, you know, like anybody does, to speak her mind. But one has to take responsibility for the damage that they're doing. And this is just, she is trumpeting both a losing and deluded cause, and doing so at the expense of some of the stuff that I would imagine she believes she supports.
But at the same time, she's been in, this is Hillary Clinton we're talking about. She has, it's almost like she has a set worldview. And as she talks about other people being propagandized, she is so unwilling to challenge her own worldview and is projecting that almost outwardly. And yet she, like, I mean, I don't know. I think it's helpful now. We've discarded the Clintons with Epstein and now with this. These are the kinds of politics we need to leave behind. This is her speaking at Miriam Adelson's conference, by the way.
One of the largest donors to Donald Trump.
So, yeah, I mean, sticking together here.
Like donated, like, almost, like, I don't know.
100 million. Over.
Over 100 million, like, probably.
This time.
yeah, this time. You know, at least, probably, at least 10%, maybe closer to 20%, maybe 40% of what he ran on.
Didn't she, like, basically pay for him to move the Capitol?
Oh, that was the first time around. First time, yes.
Too, yeah.
Students, smart, well-educated young people from our own country, from around the world, where were they getting their information? They were getting their information from social media, particularly TikTok. That is where they were learning about what happened on October 7th, what happened in the, you know, days, weeks, and months to follow. That's a serious problem. It's a serious problem for democracy, whether it's Israel or the United States, and it's a serious problem for our young people.
So you.
And it was frankly shocking to me how little the students we were encountering, not only in this class we teach, which is a very large class, international relations about crisis decision making, but students more generally. And that's why I mentioned the social media piece of it, because when you would try to talk to them to engage in some kind of reasonable discussion, it was very difficult because they did not know history. They had very little context. And what they were being told on social media was not just one-sided. It was pure propaganda. And so when you think about how to tell Israel's story, and it's important, it's not just looking internally, it's looking externally, and particularly looking at young people, because, you know, it's not just the usual suspects, it is a lot of young Jewish Americans who don't know the history and don't understand.
Okay. First off, I don't know what the F she means by the usual suspects. Oh, is there more? All right. I mean, this is so offensive. And it is so indicative of somebody who is so incredibly out of touch and so set in her ways, so convinced. Was it Bill Clinton that went and called it Judea and Samaria?
Yep.
I mean, this is even in the context of like liberal Zionism, this is bat crap crazy stuff that she's talking about.
And she has the temerity to lecture young Jewish Americans as what kind of Christian is she? I don't really care. But the fact that she can have the arrogance to sit up there and say that, and the fact that she expects a positive reaction from that audience at this Zionist fundraiser or event, essentially, says everything that we need to know about the sincerity of people believing that protecting Israel is in some way protecting Jewish people.
Put up the volume on this clip. I think it's a little bit low for people.
Who don't know the history and don't understand. Eric, I was talking to Condi Rice, and you know, she said in an interview that I did
war criminal
after the 20-point plan came out, she and I were on CBS, and she said, you know, when people were chanting from the river to the sea, she would ask the students, what river, what sea? They didn't know. I had the same experience. A lot of the challenge is with younger people. More than 50% of young people in America get their news from social media. So just pause on that for a second. They are seeing short form videos, some of them totally made up, some of them not at all representing what they claim to be showing. And that's where they get their information.
Yeah.
It's the Jordan to the Mediterranean. It is completely irrelevant.
Yeah. It doesn't matter what the names of the bodies of water are. It's about the idea that in Greater Israel, which is basically how the society has functioned in the West Bank being illegally occupied and the Gaza Strip basically being an open air concentration camp, of course, East Jerusalem too, that the reality is that Palestinians already live under Israeli rule. So when we say from the river to the sea, what we mean is an end to the occupation and equal rights for all and just dealing with the reality of everybody living together. You know, remember when she was calling Bernie Sanders supporters racist? You support an ethnostate. Remember when she was talking about how Trump's all into alternative facts or whatever? These are alternative facts. When she talks about this being driven by young people, this is just factually incorrect. Changing, and this is almost a year old, this poll, but still quite relevant. When you look at the Democrats here in terms of where negative views of Israel are rising in terms of percentage, the highest there is from 50 and older for Democrats. Because younger Democrats were already quite critical of Israel by this point. So the entire premise of what she's saying, is it all those 50-plus-year-olds that are on TikTok? That must have really spread to them now. I don't know a ton.
I got to tell you.
Yeah.
That as a over 50-year-old who looks at the social media, it's hypnotic.
Right.
I can't.
So when she lectures Jewish kids who don't know their own history, maybe she should take a look at the actual data that shows that what's really driving the fact that only 8% of Democrats, the party she's supposed to be a part of, support Israel's military action in Gaza, that must just all be TikTok hallucinations and psychosis. No, it's older people, and the information they're getting is also leading them to conclude, which now over 70% of Democrats say Israel's committing genocide. Like, who are you talking to?
This is the equivalent of like Anita Bryant saying that the problem with Vietnam is that we've got too many news media people coming and showing footage of war, and it's not right. I mean, that is exactly what the analogy is. Maybe it wasn't Anita Bryant; it was some other reactionary lunatic at the time. But that's who she is now. She is complaining not about disinformation, because they're really, I mean, honestly, like, what's the disinformation? Like, what is it that we're seeing on our TV now when 83%, if not more, of the structures in Gaza completely obliterated? When we see tens of thousands of children dead, there's no dispute about that. That's not a controversial statement by any stretch.
It is to Sarah Hurwitz. The wall of dead children?
That's what she's saying, too.
No. She agrees there's a wall of dead children. Yep. Yeah. She's just saying that it emotionally impacts people's ability to make a proper assessment about the situation.
Same point.
Like, what is the point of any of it if a wall of dead babies does not impact your decision making? Like, how sort of like demented and how much they've lost the plot. They're like, she cannot point to any type of misinformation that these kids supposedly have that has tainted their perspective on this conflict. It is a genocide. And that's the part that she is lamenting is that for the first time, we have a media universe where stuff is getting outside of the
traditional channels.
The traditional channels and is not being gatekept. That's what she is talking about.
I just can't get over the temerity of her to lecture young Jews and say they don't know their history. I mean, the amount of arrogance that she can deploy there to sit there and say that kind of thing. Perhaps young Jews really do know their history. Perhaps they understand the history of the Holocaust and they think never again for anybody. And instead of like seeing a bunch of dead babies and having the reaction as to like, this is too much for me. I can't get too emotional about opposing this genocide. Maybe that taught them like, oh, I see some of the history that I learned about in Hebrew school. Maybe I see that in these starving children, these starving people. That is like, I mean, it's an obvious lesson. And the fact that she's still trying to claim that there should be no connection is like deeply disturbing.
Even Trump, who was lying, pretended to have more empathy for those children than Hillary Clinton.
Marjorie Taylor Greene pretends to have more empathy for those children than Hillary Clinton. Like, and that I do not say that lightly.
We've got so much left here, but we got to go. I'm going to read three IMs and then get out of here. Sorry, folks. Sorry, we have run out of time again. And I'm not going to make this show 3 hours long officially. Taco time for Bonzo, garbage president. Kyle Leck. I just checked the map, Sam mentioned. It says nearby Home Depot operates two flock cameras by the intersection in front of their parking lot, one street facing and one facing the store. I wonder what those are for. And the final IM of the day, Daniel from Virginia. Emma, just roll with it, whispers, keep going, keep going.
What?
I don't know. Folks, that's it for today. Matt, Brian, Emma, great job today, folks. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the Mets are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking. Shifted it.